The following interview was conducted with Dr. Edwin H. Page for the Purdue University Oral History Program. It took place on Wednesday, August the 27th, 2008, at his residence in West Lafayette. The interviewer is Catherine Marquis, the oral history librarian. Welcome, Dr. Page. Thank you. Tell us a little bit about where you were born and your parents and your early years.
I was born in Glasgow, Kentucky in 1920. My parents are Ora and Leo Page. I was born on a farm in Glasgow, or near Glasgow. I went to school in Glasgow, graduated from high school, and in 1936. From there,
Tell us a little bit about high school. How large a school was it? Were there any activities that you participated in, student clubs?
I played in the band in high school, all through high school.
What instrument did you play?
I played trumpet.
Okay.
I've always enjoyed music and musical programs, and I played the trumpet and during high school. And then we had a National Guard, a cavalry unit there that had a band and played on horses. And I've always liked horses, and I joined a cavalry band, and we played on horses. And I stayed in that cavalry band after college while I was at Western Kentucky University, and I stayed in the cavalry for 5 years.
Very good. Did you play at the high school football games and things?
We played at the high school football games. We weren't a marching band.
Okay.
I guess they thought we couldn't march well enough to match. At least we had no training in marching at all.
The horses were it.
Yes, no, I couldn't use the horses in the band at all. Of course, they were in the cavalry, and they wouldn't allow those horses on the football field.
Okay. Then after high school, where did you go to college? And
went to college at Bowling Green, Kentucky, Western Kentucky University. At that time, it was called Western Kentucky State Teachers College. I went there on a music scholarship, which helped me considerably because in 1936 was right during the Depression, and I have two brothers, one older and one younger. The older brother was in the business university at that time, and it was quite a strain on the finances for my parents to send me to school, I thought. And so I was fortunate enough to get a scholarship that paid my tuition and so forth at Western while there. And I was lucky enough that scholarship continued for the 4 years that I was there.
Good. What was college like, and how large a school, and what clubs and things? You were probably played with them in music, too, since you had a music scholarship.
Yeah, well, I had to major in music, I felt, because of my scholarship, but I always liked biology and that sort of thing when I was younger in high school. And I also took a double major in college, in biology and in music. And my senior year was fortunate enough to get a position get a job in the biology lab, and I enjoyed that thoroughly. Mm-hmm. Enjoyed working with the students, even though I was a student myself.
Mm-hmm. Did you live on campus?
No, I lived off campus. I lived at a rooming house where we had room, board, all together.
Did they provide meals?
They provided meals. Mm-hmm. At that time, room and board for a month was $18 a month.
Wow. Very good. Yeah, very good. How large was your class? How large was your class? How many students in your class?
There were about, as I recall, about 400 students in my class.
Uh-huh. Well, good. Okay. Then, was there any professors that sort of made an impact? Do you remember any of them that you got used to some of the professors? Did you meet anyone that was particularly that you got to know?
Yes, I met two, really, that know real well. One was my major professor in biology, and he was a tremendous influence on me in wanting to go ahead and pursue a biological area of some kind eventually.
Good, okay. Well, when did you graduate then? What year?
Graduated from Western in 1940.
Okay. And then what was next?
Next, I taught school in Louisville, Kentucky High School for a year. Then I married in August of that year, 1941, when I finished that year.
Where did you meet your wife while you were in college?
I met my wife while I was in college. She came from a small town that was about 45 miles from my home. And my wife had a brother that worked for DuPont Company in the nylon area. And he kept encouraging me to apply to DuPont and go to work in nylon, that there would be a lot of room for advancement there in nylon, particularly because nylon was just becoming popular at the time. And so I resigned my position in teaching in Louisville and applied to DuPont for nylon plant in Martinsville, Virginia, and they accepted it. And so we moved there in October of 41. Okay. I stayed there until late 42, and the draft, then my brother was already been drafted, and my number came up very shortly, and I knew I was going to be drafted, and so I decided that I was going to join the Navy instead. The reason that I decided to join the Navy is in 1941, with the cavalry band that I was in, we had always gone to Frankfort, Kentucky for a summer training period, and in 41 they sent us to Wisconsin, and they shipped the horses up there by rail, and they put us in the back of a ton and a half truck with a canvas top and the back open. And when we got to our destination in Wisconsin, we were all sick from the fumes of exhaust fumes. And Wisconsin, I've never seen as many big mosquitoes in my life. They were about the size of hornets. And I made the decision then that if I had to go into service, I was going to join the Navy, because as long as I had a bed, it would be dry, and I didn't think there'd be any mosquitoes there.
Sounds good. When you got, then you got, you signed up for the Navy?
Then I signed up for the Navy. They sent me to Columbia University for a three-month midshipman school, and I graduated from there as a 90-day wonder, they called them. And I was commissioned an ensign, and then received orders to report to the West Coast and aboard the USS Louisville, a heavy cruiser. And I went there, and my wife went back to Kentucky. She was working there where she worked, and I went to California, and they said that the ship would be there in about 2 weeks, and I called my wife and told her to come on out. We had about 2 weeks there to see the area, and next morning I reported in, and they said, you're going to leave this morning, you're going up to the Aleutian Islands. So I had to call my wife and cancel her trip.
Oh no.
And I went to the Aleutian Islands and went to Adak and picked up the ship there after about a month going back and forth from one island to the other up there, and finally picked up my ship in early 1943. And then we stayed in the Pacific for the next 3 years.
Did you see some combat?
Quite a bit of combat, yes. Mm-hmm. We were assigned, we carried an admiral on there that was in charge of a task force for a bombardment force that softened up the Pacific Islands for the Marines to land. So we, our first encounter was at Roy and Namur, a couple of small islands. Then we went to Saipan, to Tinian, to Kwajalein, then eventually out to Guam, and then eventually into the Philippines.
Quite extensive.
Bombarding for the Marines to land. my responsibility on the ship after the first few months was division officer for the 5-inch guns. And my battle station was right in front of the bridge. And we had two turrets of 3 guns each, 8-inch guns, that made up our fire post in front, the two turrets, and then we had 4 5-inch guns on the side that made up, and then a bunch of automatic weapons and that sort of thing. And after the Pacific, we were in the Lingayen Gulf battle where our troops landed at on the Philippines. And
isn't that where MacArthur came back? Was that MacArthur that came back when he came back to the Philippines?
Yes, ma'am.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought I was going to get to meet MacArthur at one time. While we were at Guam, I was asked by someone to take a box of cigars and a pair of pajamas over to General MacArthur. And I said, oh boy, I'm going to get to meet the general. So they put me on the admiral's boat and we flew over to the beach, and I didn't get to see the general at all. I met an orderly, and he told me.
The general thanked you, right?
The gentleman did thank me, I'm sure, or thank the admiral that sent it over there. But that's how things happened in the Navy.
Right. Then did you get out after the war was over? Did you get out of service after the war was over?
Yes, ma'am. After the Lingayen Gulf battle, we encountered a Japanese task force of battleship cruisers and destroyers that were coming through Surigao Straits. And our intelligence was good enough that they knew that if we crossed that T with them coming up the straits, their single file, that we would have a good chance of destroying them. And that's what happened. Mm-hmm. We were able to destroy that entire task force coming up that straight single file before they had a chance to do anything to our people that were out there on a ship and that sort of thing. We went from Lingayen Gulf around Mindanao, and on Mindanao we were hit by a suicide plane. And the suicide plane hit your turret number 2, which was just below and in front of where my battle station was. And at the time, I was standing up out of the director looking around to see if planes or whatever targets I might see. And I saw a plane coming straight toward our ship from dead ahead, and we didn't have a gun that could train on that area at all. And I watched him come on in, and the explosions were occurring all around him, and he kept coming right on in, and he hit on top, or hit near turret 2. And of course, there was a big explosion and fire, and that's next thing I remember, I was on a ladder going down to sick bay. I got a flash burn from the explosion, because I was standing there watching him, really. I could see his face, and I still... Occasionally, I'll have a dream at night, and I can still see that face and that Japanese coming right toward us in that plane.
I bet. Doesn't leave your memory bank.
That's the outstanding thing that I remember.
Sure, right.
Really, I guess. Is
the ship didn't sink, though, did it? The ship did not sink?
Oh, no.
Just
it
got
didn't
damaged?
Sink.
Oh, okay.
We got hit the next day by another one at the bridge, and it killed the admiral and a number of high-ranking officers and several sailors too.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't sink it. It disabled it, and we had to come back to the Navy Yard then for repairs, which took us, seemed to me, 3 or 4 weeks to get back to the Navy Yard.
Which Navy Yard? On the West Coast or the one in the East Coast? Do you go on the California?
West Coast.
West Coast, okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it was quite a ways out, long way back.
Yeah, we went into Mare Island there on the West Coast.
Mm-hmm. And then what came next? Did you, till you stayed still in the service, even after the war was over?
No, they I had orders when the ship came back to go to Gunnery Officers Ordnance School at Washington, at the Naval Yard there. I went there and was there for 3 months, and I had further orders to go to the USS Atlanta, another heavy cruiser, and the commander there asked me if I'd be interested in staying on there as an instructor. And of course, I jumped at the chance. And I was there then for another 3 or 4 months, and then it was discharged in January of 46.
Okay. Did your wife stay in Kentucky the whole time you were in?
No, she was in Washington with me.
While
we were there.
Right. But when you were out in the Pacific, she was still at home?
She was at home in Kentucky,
mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, now that you're out of the service, what came next? What did you do after you got discharged from the service?
Well, my wife's brother was in a retail dairy business, and he wanted me to go in with him, and we put in a pasteurizer and a bottler and that sort of thing and take care of that. And I finally agreed to do that. I was thinking of going back and work for DuPont, but I'd been gone for that long and I wanted to stay at home for a while and us to be together with my wife. And so I took up his offer, really, and we put in a pasteurizing, bottling machine, and that sort of thing, and I took care of that. We produced the milk, bottled it, and he delivered it to retail customers in town. And I stayed there for 3 years, got interested in veterinary medicine while there, working with the cattle. There wasn't a veterinarian in our area, and I read a lot of veterinary books and that sort of thing and got interested in veterinary medicine. And we talked about it with Margaret's brother, and at that time we had a dairy in a town away from there that was interested in buying it, and my brother-in-law says, well, let's just sell it and you go ahead to vet school and I'll retire. And that's what we did. And I applied to Ohio State Vet School and was finally accepted there, and I went to vet school in 1949.
Okay. What was Columbus like in those days when you went there? Was it right on the campus? Was the vet school right on the campus?
Vet school was right on the campus.
Mm-hmm.
It's across the river now, I think.
Was it? Okay. Where the ag is not across the river there. Olentangy.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And did you have any children at that point?
We had one son born while we were in school.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then after you finished, was that program 4 years?
It was 4 years.
Okay.
So I finished there in 1953, went back to Kentucky and practiced in Kentucky for 11 years.
Private practice?
In private practice. Well, there was three of us in a partnership. And in my hometown. And...
Well, that was nice.
We practiced there. I practiced there for 11 years, and then I got a call from Purdue, and they encouraged me to come and look, and I was happy where I was. We had excuse me, had two children at the excuse me. We had two children at the time, and I was on the school board, and I was happy, and my family was happy and doing well. My children were in school, and I finally agreed to come to Purdue after a couple of visits here.
What year was that?
1964.
Okay. What was the campus like? Lynn Hall had been built, though. There was a building, though, for the vet school, wasn't there?
Oh, yes.
Right,
yes.
Okay.
They'd graduated their first class in 63.
Okay.
The school was started in 59.
Right, okay. Now, when you first came then, you came in 64, what was your teaching? Tell us a little bit about what your responsibilities when you
My
first
responsibility,
came.
My responsibility, I came as an associate professor of large animal clinics, and my teaching responsibility was in the classroom, I taught equine medicine, And in the clinic, I worked with the students with the large animals, horses, cattle, sheep, goats, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What was the enrollment at that time, Bob?
If I recall correctly, it's 40-some students.
Mm. Now they have, close to 70 or 72?
Yes.
They keep it, it's on the small side.
Yes.
Right. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Okay. And what was your research area when you first came? Was it an equine?
Well, I wasn't a trained researcher at all. My goal was to, when I came to Purdue, was to be the best teacher I could be and to assist the students in accomplishing their goal of graduating from the School of Veterinary Medicine. And I looked upon almost every case as a research case. Is there anything that we can do differently that would improve the health of that animal and let him help him get well faster and better and do it in a humane manner?
Did you go out to the farms and things because you were in large animal? Did you make calls?
I stayed at the clinic all the time.
But some of them would go out to the farm.
Oh, yes, we had ambulatory clinicians that went to the farm and took care of the mm-hmm. animals on the farm.
Right, okay. And then you became head of the large animal clinic in 1975.
Yes, ma'am.
So then things changed a little bit for you. You were the head of the department, and tell us a little bit about some of the projects and the challenges that you faced and handled.
Well, at that time, most people on farms had either a few cows or a few pigs or a few sheep, horses or whatever. They didn't have the large farms that they have now.
The farms were smaller in size in those days?
They were much smaller in size. At least the animals on the farm were much smaller in size. In the 70s and 80s, even in the late 60s, they began to have larger operations. The swine operations were growing, and we had several large swine operations operating in the Indiana. And the same thing with cattle, primarily with beef cattle. And dairies, there were some dairies that were growing and getting larger all of the time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay.
Just like now, there's a dairy up north that has about 25,000 cows.
Fair Oaks?
Fair Oaks Farm. Mm-hmm.
Right. Then they came over from Holland, I think.
Yes, sir.
All right, okay. Tell us, what about students, the enrollment in the school changed?
Enrollment has changed considerably. When I was in school, there were no females in veterinary medicine. When I came to Purdue, if I recall correctly, we had two, maybe three females. Now, they say the applications for veterinary school is 90% female. And that on a national average, they say that the veterinary population is approaching 50%. I'm not sure that that's accurate, right, but that's what I read
right.
and hear.
Okay. When you first took over, what was the placement? What sort of careers, where did they go when they finished? Did some go into large animal or practice?
At that time, there was a smaller percentage of them that went into small animal practice than into large animal practice. But as large animal practice has changed, as we've moved from a few animals to a farm to a congregation of animals, it's changed. The population now is going much larger small animal than it is large animal.
Okay. Tell us a little about, one of your research areas was acupuncture.
Mm-hmm.
And tell us a little bit about that and how that interest.
I became interested in acupuncture because I read an article that my daughter had written on acupuncture when she was in high school. This was in the 70s. And quite frankly, I didn't believe it. I thought it was related to hypnosis or mind over body and that sort of thing. I had no idea that there was any truth in what I was reading.
And what prompted her interest to write a paper on that? Was that for a school report?
My daughter?
Yeah.
It was a school report. And I don't know how she came to write a paper on that.
Interesting topic.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
But she did, and I happened to read it, and that's where we started. Well, the more I thought about it, it seemed to me logical that animals would be the one that we should try it on to see if it really worked. And I found a ad that we're going to have an acupuncture meeting, and I wrote and went to that meeting. And when I got there, I found that it was a meeting of physicians. And I sat, of course, with physicians in the room, and I was sitting close to a young fellow, and we were talking, and he found out that I was a veterinarian. He says, "What are you doing here?" And I says, "I'm here, I guess, because I don't believe it." I says, "What are you doing here?" He says, "Well, I guess I'm here because I do believe it." I says, "Why?" He says, "Well, I just came back from Vietnam not too long ago, and I saw where a lot of people there had been treated with acupuncture, and they swore by it. They thought it was the greatest thing that had come along." And he said, "In talking to them, I thought it might be worthwhile for me to look into it, and that's why I'm here." And the more I've studied it, I went to other meetings in acupuncture and decided that, well, let's try it on animals and see what happens. And so
it had not been done on animals, been more on humans?
It'd been on humans. Mm-hmm. So I tried it on animals. The first one I tried it on was on a horse. I didn't think I could manipulate the mind of that horse. If he didn't like something, he'd let me know about it. And of course, I grew up with horses and had worked with them. But this was a case of facial paralysis. The facial nerve comes down over the side of the jaw from the base of the ear and branches and runs around to their nose and to the lower lip. And the ones that I had seen, their nose would be pulled to one side and the lip on the affected side would droop and they would lose a lot of feed and that sort of thing. And so I was taught that nerve did not regenerate. Well, in acupuncture, they said that you can regenerate nerve by using the electrical stimulation and the needles at certain points. So I said, "Well, this would be a good way to try it." And I had never seen a horse that had facial paralysis from a traumatic injury. And usually they're injured because of the bridle or the halter one was not fit exactly right, and people were rough with it, jerk it, and they would injure the nerve because the nerve passes down right over the bone. And the horse that I started on had been that way, according to the owner, by about 6 months. And I told him, "I don't know whether it'll work, but we'll try it." And he says, "Well, he's a good horse. Let's try it." He says, "I want to save him if there's any way." And we did, and we treated him daily. And by the third week, I noticed that he had a little sensation in that nose. That side of the nose, you could tap him with a needle lightly, and he would let you know it. So we kept on treating him, and then we went to every other day, and then twice a week, and once a week for about 3 to 4 months, and he came back normal, and that really set me afire.
Had they tried anything before that for the paralysis? Had they tried anything on the horse before you tried the acupuncture?
No. They hadn't tried anything because we didn't know what to try.
Right. Did they bring the horse to the vet school, or did you?
No, they brought him to the vet school.
Okay, so you did the, and so you kept him there for quite a while.
Yeah, we kept him there for quite a while.
I bet the owner was happy.
He was happy. He and I was happy.
Right. Oh, both. Terrific. Then, did you continue on with the acupuncture? Also, there was an international acupuncture society. Were you involved with that?
Yes, I was.
Okay.
International Veterinary Acupuncture Society. Uh-huh. Yes, I went to that and attended the meetings and so forth. I knew all of the people there, and I tried it on cows, using it on the in the flank of cows, opening those up, doing surgery on them by placing needles in the animal. And it takes about 10 to 15 minutes for that needle to start taking effect, for that action to start taking effect. But it seems to have a relaxing effect on the animal. And we take a scalpel and open that flank up, go in, palpate the rumen and so forth, my back, suture it up, and the animal would stand there and not move. I've done that on cattle, done that on horses. I felt strong enough about it that I talked to a couple of students and they were willing to help, and I said, let's try this for a student AVMA chapter meeting one night at their meeting. And we did. I said, let's get a dog that we've never seen before, and we'll put two needles in his leg. We'll wait about 10 or 15 minutes and we'll try it and see if we can desensitize his abdomen and open up the abdomen. And we did that, and the students opened up the abdomen and sutured it back up.
Good afternoon. At 3:15 is a Wednesday worship.
And that sort of thing. And a few minutes, he began to settle down, and within a little over 10 minutes, he lay down and stretched out. Was perfectly calm, and they rolled him over on his back and opened him up, no problem at all. When they'd finished suturing him, turned him loose, he got up, turned around, and if he didn't come over and lick my hand.
Animals are lovely.
So that's I probably, as I thought about it afterward, I probably was crazy for attempting it. Because if it had failed, I would have been the laughing stock of the veterinary school.
Are they still using it, the acupuncture? What's the status of it today with animals?
Some are still using it in animals, not at Purdue. To my knowledge, there's no one there that's using acupuncture.
Okay. Is it used in some other places in the United States?
Oh,
on
yes.
Animals?
Oh, yes. It's okay. Used quite a bit.
Uh-huh. And they use it on humans too, don't they?
Use it on humans quite a bit, I'm told.
Right. Okay. Now the School of Vet Med has tell some changes. You had some deans when you came. Erskine Morse was the dean when you came, wasn't he?
Yes, sir.
And then Jack Stockton and Hugh Lewis.
Jack Stockton and then Hugh Lewis.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. So they brought each one brings a little. The school has grown over time.
Yes, the school has grown over time. It's changed over time. Of course, they've built a new diagnostic lab that's on the south campus now. And
what about a graduate program? Is that's increased over time?
The graduate program is increased. We had a graduate student that was doing his work in another area, but he worked in the clinic on horses. They were looking at the blood of the horse to see if it changed in hormone levels. And they found that it caused the animal to produce a hormone level that was, give the animal a feeling of well-being or satisfaction, settled him down. And that's what the papers say about humans, that it gives you a feeling of well-being.
Yeah, that's nice. Yeah, the students' enrollment has increased over time. How long? Also, how long were you the head of the large animal clinic?
from 1975 to 1985.
Okay. And then did you return to teaching and research?
No, I retired.
Oh, okay. Well, tell us a little about what you did in your retirement activities.
Well, not a lot, I guess.
But you decided to stay in the community.
We stayed in the same community because our daughter and son-in-law and two grandchildren were here.
Okay.
We stayed with the grandchildren a lot. Our daughter and son-in-law both work there at Arnett Clinic, and my wife felt that we should be close to those grandchildren and help them in any way we could.
And you had two sons? You had a son? You had a son?
We have a son that's in Pittsburgh.
Okay. Does he have children?
No, he and his wife do not have children. He's in an emergency room there in Pittsburgh.
He's a medical doctor?
Yes, sir.
Did he go to Purdue?
No, he went to Indiana University.
And then to IU Med Center, Med School?
And then to IU Med School.
Okay.
Well, he went to Duke University before he went to IU Med School.
Okay. Let's see. You got some awards. You got the Distinguished Alumnus Award at one time, too. And some other awards. You got the IBMA President's Award.
Yes, sir.
All right.
Where'd you get all this?
Oh, I have to do my research. Let me talk about Chauncey Village. How has Chauncey Village changed since you've been here? I usually ask the people that, particularly what it was like when you first came, 60s and 70s.
It's changed a lot.
Has it gotten bigger?
Seems to me it's much bigger. Much more traffic, a lot more people there. It may be because there's more students on campus.
It's a combination.
Well, I guess so. But it seems much bigger. There's a lot more activity going on there than there was a service station there on the corner of Grant Street and State Street when I first came here.
Mm-hmm. Right. I went to that station. Bill Davis owned that.
Yeah.
And then he moved out there to Yeager Road in 52.
Yeah.
And then he gave that up, and now it's BP. Right. Yeah. What are some of the other activities that you got engaged in when you retired? Did you do any traveling?
We traveled some. We had a little orange grove in Florida.
Did you have a house down there too?
We got a condo down there. And in fact, we still have it. I gave the little orange grove to my children, and they had it for about 4 years. And some lady from Miami came along and wanted to buy it, and so I said, sell it, because things were changing a lot in that business, and they did. And then we have a little farm in Kentucky that my wife and I reworked an old tenant house there, and we spent some time there.
And you still have it?
Still have it.
Okay. Do you raise it? Is there any crops on the farm?
No crops, had cattle.
You still have cattle?
Still have cattle.
Okay.
Raised hay and pasture.
Okay.
Raised tobacco until the tobacco program by the government went into effect, and they don't raise tobacco anymore.
Okay. All right. What did you do with the little orange grove? Did you work in the orange grove? Tell us a little about that.
I used to work some in there when we'd go down in the summer. I'd sucker it and I'd spray underneath and that sort of thing.
You had to bring back oranges for your friends when you came back.
Yeah, that's right. I had to bring back a carload of oranges.
Otherwise, you're not allowed back.
That's right.
The children, I'm sure the children enjoyed it.
Oh, they enjoyed it a lot.
Yeah.
They enjoyed it a lot.
Yeah. Whereabouts in Florida was it located?
Lake Wales.
Okay. Is that
just south of Orlando?
Oh, okay.
On US 27.
Orlando has changed for you over time, I bet.
Orlando has changed tremendously.
Since Disney moved to town.
Yeah.
Yeah. let me ask you, do you have a favorite Purdue tradition? Any tradition that sticks in your mind, a Purdue tradition that you'd like to share with us?
Tradition?
Mm-hmm.
Well, one that my wife and I thoroughly enjoyed was the band, Glee Club, and the Purdueettes. We went to all of the Christmas shows. We'd go to the games, enjoy the football, the band playing at the football games. We loved to see them march in and march out, and loved to hear the Purdueettes. And we'd love to go to the Victory Varieties, I think they were called at the time.
I missed those. Those were very good.
We enjoyed those very much.
Right. They were still going on when I came, and sometimes when my brother and sister-in-law would come, we would do that as part of the things to do on the weekend.
Yeah.
You know, but they're not anymore.
No, they stopped those. I don't know why, but it may have been too hard to get the people. I don't know.
Yeah, right. How about an outstanding event in your life? Does something come to mind?
Well, probably the outstanding event in my mind, I don't like to remember it particularly, but I still pops up in my dreams every once in a while, and that's this Japanese plane coming at us before it hit us. I was standing there watching him and saw him come in, and I could still see his expression there in my dream.
Right. That doesn't leave your memory bank. Yeah. Any closing comments that you'd like to share with the researchers in summary? Anything special you'd like to say?
Well, I thoroughly enjoyed my time at Purdue. I enjoyed the students very much. When I came here, I said my responsibility was primarily to the students. It was to do the best I could to help them accomplish their goals. And next, it was to the owners of the animals that brought their animals into the clinic, that I should do the best I could to meet their needs and to do it in a humane manner as far as the animal was concerned. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. I enjoyed both the students and the clients.
Yeah, right. Good.
I was fortunate enough to get some teaching awards, which I very much appreciated. And I don't know why, but maybe it was because that was the reason that I felt I should be here, is to work with the students, and I enjoyed them. My wife enjoyed the student wives. Some of them were married at the time, and she enjoyed them because she was a student wife while I was in school.
So she could identify.
She could identify with them.
Right, yeah. Do you still keep in touch with some of the students?
Oh, yes. I still hear from some of them.
That's nice. Yeah. It's good to share memories and things like that.
I enjoy hearing to from them.
Okay. Thank you very much.
And I learned a lot from the students. They have their own thoughts and thinking about things, and they will bring up things that I might not think of. So hopefully it was reciprocal. They learned something from me, and I learned from them.
Very good. Yeah. Thank you, Dr. Page. This has been very nice. This ends the interview. Thank you very much.